Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, Papal Audience. Pope Benedict reflects on the wondrous and joyful mystery of Jesus' incarnation at Christmas during his first Wednesday General Audience of the new year. Memories of the 1964 papal visit to the Holy Land. Spotlight on the U.S. Ordinariate. We speak to the head of the U.S. Ordinariate set up this week by the Vatican for Anglicans seeking full communion with Rome, according to the norms laid down in the document Anglicanorum Cedibus. And rebuilding lives after disaster. The Pope's prayer intentions for January are that the victims of natural disasters may receive the spiritual and material comfort they need to rebuild their lives. And we shine the spotlight on one aid project sponsored by the Catholic Development Agency, CAFOD, in Haiti. At his first Wednesday General Audience of the new year, Pope Benedict reflected on the wondrous and joyful mystery of Jesus' incarnation at Christmas time. Chris Altieri reports.
Dear brothers and sisters,
speaking to thousands of faithful gathered in the Paul VI Audience Hall this Wednesday for his weekly general audience, Pope Benedict XVI said the Christmas season is one of celebration, in which we express our joy in the mystery of Christ's coming into the world.
From the witness of Scripture and the Church's tradition, we see that our first reaction to the birth of Jesus should be one of joy, in the knowledge that God has assumed our humanity in order to make us sharers in his own divine life. The contemplation of this wondrous exchange, which we experience most powerfully in the Eucharist, invites us to recognize our lofty dignity as God's adopted sons and daughters.
The liturgy, said Pope Benedict, teaches us that Christmas is a feast of light. For Christ, the light of the world and the radiance of the Father's glory, has brought us from darkness into his kingdom of light, and called us to be the light of the gospel to every creature.
During this Christmas season, may we welcome the newborn Savior into our hearts, and may our lives be transformed by his gifts of joy, newness, and light.
Following the catechesis, the Holy Father offered special greetings to pilgrims in many languages, including English.
I am pleased to greet all English-speaking visitors present, including the pilgrimage groups from Wales, Australia, and the United States. Of a special greeting to the priests and seminarians of the Pontifical College Josephinum. My welcome also goes to the La Salette brothers taking part in a program of spiritual renewal. I thank the choirs for their praise of God in song. Upon all of your families, I invoke the Lord's blessings of joy, peace, and prosperity for the year which has just begun. Happy New Year!
Wednesday's general audience was the first of the new year 2012. I'm Chris Altieri.
On January the 4th, 1964, history was made when Pope Paul VI began the first ever papal visit to the Holy Land. Lasting less than 2 days, the visit took the Pope to the main holy sites in Nazareth, Jerusalem, and Bethlehem, and included several important ecumenical meetings. Pope Paul's visit in that January of 1964 marked the first time that a Roman pontiff had ever travelled in a plane, and it was also the first time a reigning pope had left Italy in more than a century. The newspapers of that date hailed the announcement of Pope Paul's visit to the Holy Land as astonishing, saying he clearly wished to go beyond every historical precedent. On his arrival in Jordan at the start of his trip, The Pope stressed that his visit was purely pastoral and described it as a humble pilgrimage to the holy sites. Let's hear his first words on that visit, which were spoken in English, after he was welcomed at Amman Airport by King Hussein of Jordan, whose nation then controlled East Jerusalem before it was captured by Israel in the 1967 war.
Our visit is a spiritual one, a humble pilgrimage to the sacred places made holy by the birth, the life, the passion and death of Jesus Christ, and by his glorious resurrection and ascension. At each of these venerable shrines, we shall pray for the peace which Jesus left to his disciples, that peace which the world cannot give, but which comes from the fulfillment of his commandment, to love one another as he loved us.
And that was the voice of Pope Paul VI, speaking his first words on the soil of the Holy Land. But what memories do people in Jerusalem and elsewhere have of that historic papal visit? Father Ignazio Mancini is a former Franciscan custos of the Holy Land and helped organise the 1964 papal visit there. He has no doubt about the groundbreaking importance of that pilgrimage.
I remember that event. It was a very great event, and everybody was happy and glad to receive the Pope after St. Peter. It was the first visit of a Pope in Jerusalem. After that visit, we had several visits, but that one was immemorable. I remember all, and I have in my heart, and everybody here in Jerusalem remember that event as a great event. It was an event of the century.
Another person who has clear memories of that historic papal visit to Jerusalem in January 1964 is Youssef Nasrawi, a Palestinian Catholic who now works as a vice principal in a Jerusalem school run by the Franciscans. He was 18 years old at that time and was acting as a scout leader in Jerusalem. And he talks about the excitement it generated, especially among the Catholic community in the city.
When the Pope came, it was my first year as a teacher in Terra Santa High School. I was with the school scout group. The Pope was supposed to come from the Damascus Gate, no other way to enter the old city through the market to the Holy Sepulchre. And it was really a great event for us. People from all around the West Bank and the East Bank at that time, from Jordan, they came all, and the square was crowded with people. So I was with the scout, and my station was at the Schmidt Girls College near the Damascus Gate Square.
And so what were your feelings when this visit occurred and seeing the Pope?
Well, it was something unusual for us as Christians in the old city of Jerusalem. It was a big joy to see the Pope Paul the VI coming to Jerusalem, and we all rushed the car when the car arrived to Damascus Gate, but the security were around and they forbid us from coming near the Pope, and we followed the Pope through the streets of the old city, through the souk, which is the market, until he was welcomed by the clergymen in the square of the Holy Sepulchre.
And how did the Palestinian Christians feel about this visit?
Of course, it was a lot of excitement. We were very happy. It was something unusual for us to see the head of the Catholic Christians all over the world coming to visit us. It was something strange for us, and it was a very rare experience, and we were very, very, very happy and excited. It was very cold at that day. I remember it was very cold, and we were all, the scouts were only wearing the shirts and the shorts, and we were shivering from cold, but the visit gave us warmth, you know. We didn't feel the cold anymore. When we saw the Pope coming, entering Jerusalem, we followed him all the way.
Was there interest also among the general population? Was it just really something for the Christian community?
Yes, also our brothers, the Muslims also were very happy because, you know, Jerusalem depends mainly on tourism, and this would encourage the Christian pilgrimage to the Holy Land and to Jerusalem in particular. And at that time, thousands of pilgrims and tourists came also to share with us this moment. So our brothers, the Muslims, were very happy because they depend mainly on tourism also. And tourism comes from the Christian. At that time, no Jews were allowed to come to Jerusalem, so they depended on the Christian tourism and pilgrims.
And what for you were some of the most significant, the most moving points of the papal visit, what he saw and did? I know he saw the main sites.
The significant part when he visited the sick man, he entered her house and gave her the blessing. And this was a great turn from the Pope.
Pope Paul VI's final engagement before leaving Jerusalem was a visit to the house of a sick man who was confined to his bed for many years. For security reasons, this visit was only announced at the last minute. A retired accountant, Issa Hanna Souda, is a Palestinian Catholic who lived in the same housing complex as the sick man, and thus was lucky enough to witness this papal visit at first hand. He begins by telling us how he learnt the news from his local parish priest just minutes before the Pope's arrival at his house, and didn't believe what the priest was telling him.
Yes. Father Curé Dominique Piki, yes, was our curé.
He was your priest?
Yes. He came to my house when the father entered the house and told me that he visits you, the Pope. I told you, I never believed. After 10 minutes, the Pope was entering my house to visit the sick man. We have a big space down where I live, and the Pope was entering with some Jordanian bodyguards. It was so nice. I feel like I am a king. My neighbor put a cup of coffee and he drank it. And we, till now, we have the cup of coffee in the house.
And why did the Pope come to your neighbor's house?
A neighbor of mine named Mathia Nahas was in bed for 25 years. When the Pope entered to him and saw him, he kneeled near the bed and prayed, and he asked many things, the old people, but he cannot answer any question. I feel glad that he ended his visit in Jerusalem in my house. And then I put him a big loaf of bread with salt, and he cut a small piece and put salt on it and eat it. It was wonderful, and nobody believes that the Pope is in my house. I feel that I am lucky, and I have pictures of this, 3 pictures of the Pope while entering the house, and I was so glad meeting him in my area. It was very, very, very nice.
That was Issa Souda, a Palestinian Catholic in Jerusalem. And earlier you heard the voices of Youssef Nasrari, another Palestinian Catholic from Jerusalem, and of Father Ignazio Mancini, the former Franciscan Custos of the Holy Land, who helped organize the papal visit. The Vatican has announced the establishment of a U.S. ordinariate for Anglicans seeking full communion with Rome under the norms laid down in the document Anglican Norum Cedibus. The U.S. ordinariate is the second to be established, following Pope Benedict's decision in 2009 to create a structure for traditionalist Anglicans wishing to join the Catholic Church. The first ordinariate was established in England and Wales in January 2011. Based in Houston, Texas, the new personal ordinariate of the Chair of St. Peter will serve former Anglican laypeople and clergy in the U.S. who wish to become Catholics. The head of the new ordinariate is Father Geoffrey Steenson, a former Episcopal bishop who resigned from the Anglican Communion in 2007. My colleague Chris Altieri spoke to Father Steenson to find out more about this move and its significance.
We're all trying to kind of come to terms with the technical canonical language, which is not something that's natural to many of us. But the idea of ordinariate is a word that was chosen because already there is a model in the military ordinariate, the structure for military chaplains who serve across diocesan territorial boundaries. And so I think that was a model that was used when the Holy See erected this. And it's personal because it relates to the gathering up of people that have a liturgical and ecclesial culture that would be distinct from the territorial diocese, which encompasses obviously every Catholic soul within a geographical region. So the idea of personal is that it relates to a unique group of people, those that are coming from the Anglican tradition, and it's an ordinariate in the sense that it has a juridical structure that is similar to that of a diocese.
And you have been elected to lead this ordinariate. A difference, perhaps, between you and the head of the military ordinariate is that you are not you're not a Catholic bishop, but you will have care of souls for the people who are in the or under the ordinariate, right?
Yes. Oh, yes, that's right. I was ordained in the Catholic Church under the pastoral provision. Because I'm a married priest, I'm not able to receive episcopal ordination because of the very ancient traditions of the Church on that subject. But people have told me that it's almost the second best thing. I'll have all the headaches of a bishop without any of the honors. So I think that the idea, though, is that there is this responsibility to care for souls, to look after the priests who will be incarnated in the ordinariate and the lay faithful that will become members as well. So I think all of the responsibilities that a bishop has will accrue to the work of the ordinary of the ordinariate.
I'm sure we could go on for hours and hours and hours, but maybe if I think you're in an elevator and you have 45 seconds to express your feelings about this creation of the ordinariate, go ahead. Here we are. The doors are closed.
Yes. I think that in Anglicanism, there has always been this deep-seated desire for Catholic unity. It was in our DNA because we came from the Catholic Church. And so I always think of it as in terms of the instincts of a migratory bird, that want to come home. And that's, I think, the heart and soul of what the ordinariate is all about, is what Lumen Gentium, Section 8, the Constitution, or the Constitution on the Church, speaks about, this inner dynamic toward Catholic unity that exists in other ecclesial traditions. And that inner dynamic inexorably brings us home to Rome. And that is the real heart and soul of the ordinariate to me. It is this desire to be at one with Peter and the apostles and his successors and those who are gathered around him. My favorite text from St. Irenaeus of Lyon about this question is that it is necessary that all churches be in accord with this church, the Church of Rome, because of her more excellent apostolic foundations. She's the church that was built on Peter and Paul. And that is the vision that we have. That's the goal that we have. And we want to arrive in the full life of the Catholic Church with much joy in our hearts.
That was Father Jeffrey Steenson, head of the newly established U.S. Ordinariate for former Anglicans, speaking to my colleague Chris Altieri. Benedict's prayer intentions for this January are that the victims of natural disasters may receive the spiritual and material comfort they need to rebuild their lives. One impoverished country which has been hit by a series of natural disasters in recent years is the Caribbean nation of Haiti. The most recent of those disasters was the devastating earthquake that struck the Haitian capital Port-au-Prince in January 2010, killing nearly a quarter of a million people. Almost exactly 2 years on from the earthquake, hundreds of thousands of Haitians are still homeless, and the country is still struggling to get back on its feet again. Along with its local Caritas partners, the Catholic Development Agency CAFOD has been at the forefront of helping the victims of Haiti's earthquake to rebuild their shattered lives. Mike Noyes is CAFOD's senior humanitarian officer and has frequently visited Haiti over the last year and saw at first hand a local rehousing project supported by the charity.
Like everything in Haiti, estimates vary, but people are saying that there's still something like 500,000 people who are homeless now, some 2 years on, and that compares to something like 2 million who were made homeless by the earthquake.
And how would you describe the mood of the Haitian people? You know, they're the poorest country in the Western Hemisphere. They've had a history of natural disasters, also political instability. Yet they're very resilient, aren't they?
People are incredibly resilient in Haiti, as they are in so many countries around the world. I think in terms of the mood of the people, one of the things that has perhaps been sort of most difficult for many has been the long process that it's taken for Haiti to get a new government after the elections of the end of 2010. It took the best part of a year to actually put a government in place, and that has hampered the recovery and rebuilding efforts quite considerably. What you do see a lot is where people are, you know, able to access land to rebuild, or where they've been able to move to a new temporary shelter site where, you know, they're able to put down some sorts of roots. You see people rebuilding their lives again quite quickly. You see people who have moved to what is a temporary site in effect, but are already making improvements in terms of their homes, in terms of things like decorating, replacing doors and windows of the temporary shelters with something more to their taste and liking. So you see people investing in their futures already, and that's very encouraging to see.
Many of the people in Haitians, of course, are Catholic, and some people are saying that, in fact, this devastating natural disaster has made their faith even stronger than before. I mean, how important has their faith been for Haitians? And do you find, in fact, that it has made their faith stronger?
I think when you speak to ordinary people, you know, references to God and such like are sort of litter their conversations. Faith and religious identity is a very important thing for Haitians. And I think certainly immediately after the earthquake, we saw people turning to religion and to the church for solace. And the church has continued to provide solace and healing and recovery to people. And I'm sure that has sort of reinforced their belief and reinforced their faith.
Right, let's look now at some of CAFOD's projects. You say that you've been involved in a project of building earthquake-proof homes.
Yes, we're working with a range of Caritas partners, not just ourselves, but people like the Swiss, the Australians and the Irish, you know, working very closely in collaboration with the local Haitian partners and Caritas Haiti. One of the activities we've been involved with is in the district of Gressier, which is just outside Port-au-Prince, closer to the centre of the earthquake, where we've been supporting a process to rebuild 100 new earthquake-resistant homes for people who lost everything during the earthquake. So these were people who lived primarily on farming and suddenly found themselves without a home to stand on, a home to live in without anything, and where, you know, after what's been a difficult process, because these are people living high in the mountains, away from roads, away from water supplies, away from sort of most of the basic amenities of life, where thanks to the incredible work of our partners locally, we've been able to see the rebuilding of new solid earthquake-resistant and importantly also hurricane resistance homes for a number of people. I mean, the first few are already finished. The inaugurations will formally take place at the time of the second anniversary on the 12th of January, and then people are already moving in, and there's more being finished as we speak.
Provide me with any anecdotes. I know, for instance, that you met when you went out there an elderly lady called Celine, who was a beneficiary of help from CAFOD. Tell me a little bit about what her situation was like after the earthquake struck and what it's like now.
Yes, one of the people who's received one of the first houses that's been built in Grecia is a lady called Celine. She's a widow with grown-up sons and daughters. When I first saw Madame Celine, we were forced, because of the condition of the roads and the weather, to walk up the hills to where she lived. And this was a walk of about 45 minutes to an hour, sort of constantly uphill, sometimes sliding backwards because of the mud, up to the top of the hills, overlooking the Port-au-Prince and the bay where she lives and has a small fruit farm. Now, at the time, Madame Celine's house, which was completely destroyed in the earthquake, was still in ruins, and she was living in a small hut made partly from the timbers rescued from her house and some tarpaulings and some plastic sheeting. She was clearly identified as being one of the people in greatest need in an area where everyone was in need, and, as I say, has been one of the first people to receive a new house thanks to the work of our partners in the area. When I visited her just before Christmas, I saw her outside her new house. She was anxious to move in, but she wasn't yet allowed to move in because there was an agreement with everyone that they were working together in solidarity and they had lost their homes together in solidarity. The first 10 families wouldn't move in until all 10 houses were built. So she had an almost complete house. She had a new three-roomed cement and concrete house with solid roofing, solid doors, designed in such a way as to be earthquake-resistant and hurricane-resistant, and she was thrilled. When I spoke to her, she said, "I don't believe this. I didn't believe what happened on the 12th of January 2 years ago when the earthquake struck and I lost everything. I didn't even have a chair. I didn't even have a table. I couldn't imagine then that I would have this now wonderful new home to be living in."
And tell me, what further plans does CAFOD and your local partners have in the future for continuing this effort to rebuild people's lives after this disaster?
CAFOD doesn't just rush in and rush out when emergencies happen. So we have medium and long-term plans for our work in Haiti, and we were already working in Haiti before the earthquake. What we'll be doing over the next 12 months is continuing to work on new shelter programs, building new earthquake-resistant houses, working very, very closely with our partners, particularly National Caritas, so particularly the Diocese of Port-au-Prince and the Diocese of Jacmel, in the building of new homes. We're also working with many other of our partners, such as the Jesuit Refugee Service, in terms of helping people recover and rebuild their livelihoods that were destroyed during the earthquake. And we're continuing with other partners to work on the move so that people who have moved out of camps and are returning to their homes and their neighbourhoods have safe water supplies, have decent homes to live in, and hopes for the future.
How do you feel in all about Haiti's future?
Haiti's future was going to be difficult before the earthquake. That hasn't changed. There are many, many challenges. It is a very, very poor country. It is a very, very strong and a very, very resilient country. Given the right conditions and the right support, Haiti can do a lot.
I was speaking to Mike Noyes of CAFOD about his recent visit to Haiti. Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.